More Idaho Matters right now. Back in 1966, a mining company had a plan to develop an open pit mine in the North Cascade Mountains in Washington State. Endangering the Glacier Peak Wilderness area, though, local and national conservations got to work. And in a story that defies what you might expect, the underdog won, and the mining company never broke ground as originally planned. And that's a story told by University of Idaho professor Adam Sowards in his new book, An Open Pit Visible from the Moon, The Wilderness Act and the Fight to Protect Miners Ridge and the Public Interest. And Adam is joining us live now to talk more about this. Welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me.
Okay, so take us back to the 1960s. A copper mine was gearing up to start mining a section in Washington State that we mentioned in the opening when conservationists stepped in. So can you give us a brief history of that story?
Absolutely. So in the 1950s, Kennecott Copper Corporation acquired some mining claims in what became Glacier Peak Wilderness Area. And the Wilderness Act passed in 1964, and included in that was a compromise that allowed any mining company to go ahead and keep mining in a wilderness area and keep prospecting and looking for new mines. And so in 1966, when Kennecott announced its intention to build this mine in the middle of a really beautiful part of the North Cascades, conservationists were shocked and angered, and everyone saw this as a tremendous test for the Wilderness Act. Was that compromise going to be allowed to stand? Would the company be able to break open their mine, or would the conservationists win? They didn't win in stopping the compromise in the first place, but maybe they could in practical matters get it stopped. And everyone was trying to get the public interest involved here in how they define the public interest. So the conservationists saw it as far more important for the public to have the scenic values that this area in the Glacier Peak Wilderness area represented. And the company wanted to make sure that the mining company could continue to push its claims forward and open mines in wilderness areas as they were allowed by the Wilderness Act. And the Forest Service, which had jurisdiction, was trying to play referee, and it was still establishing its procedures for how to deal with this situation. Throughout all of 1967, a variety of conservationists from the national level to the local level worked really hard to throw up roadblocks and make arguments for why we shouldn't have this mine. And it proceeded and intensified, and then it just kind of petered out, and the mine never happened.
So if you were there in 1966 when this activism came up to not have this mine, not just, you know, be built, I mean, but not even groundbroken on it, would you have thought that conservationists would have been successful?
That's a good question. And you would have, I think, no reason to believe that you would be able to stop a multinational corporation like Kennecott Copper. The law was on their side. And one of the interesting things that was part of the activism is everyone acknowledged that. You had high-level administrators in the federal government saying, yes, it's legal, but it's not right. And that becomes one of the important talking points through all of these campaigns. It may be legal, but it's not the right thing to do.
Was that how some of them protested, or what were some of the ways people protested the mine? Was it just as simple as, yes, this is the law, but it is not right?
So there's a variety of activities, and there are speeches that are made. The Secretary of Agriculture, who is in charge of the Forest Service, made a big speech at a wilderness conference sponsored by the Sierra Club, and he made that argument. A Supreme Court justice named William O. Douglas, who was from Washington State and knew the Glacier Peak area well, he led what was called a hike-in near the trailhead that went up to Miner's Ridge. And he made, I mean, this is a Supreme Court justice, and he says, you know, the law may say one thing, but it doesn't really matter because the right thing to do is to not put this mine in. But you also have college students around the country, especially at the University of Washington, but also all around the country, doing things. One student came out from Ohio and worked for months and months in the summer and wrote a thesis in his college and also created a petition and had scientists across the country sign on and say this was an irresponsible thing to do. And he managed somehow, I'm not sure how, but he got a meeting with the president of Kennecott, traveled to Manhattan and met with him. One of my favorite stories of activism is a local doctor from a town called Mount Vernon. And he bought, I believe, 3 shares of stock in Kennecott so he could go speak at the shareholder meeting. And he traveled to New York and said, I'm a shareholder, and if you open this mine, you're going to ruin the value of my investment, because in the public's eye, you will be seen as doing something terrible. So there's just a variety
that is fascinating.
Of these things that people did at the time.
Yeah. So here's what's interesting, I think, just talking with you. Is it sounds like there's some similarities between what happened in 1966 and what we're seeing here in Idaho in the white clouds right now. So can you talk a little bit about that? I mean, it just sounds like there are some similarities.
There are, in fact, a lot of similarities between what went on at Miner's Ridge through 66 through 68 and what was going on virtually the same time in the white clouds. There, it's a different mining company. It's a Sarco, and they're wanting to put in a mine, and the public gets really aroused. And in fact, if you look in the history, you will see many of the activists who are working at regional or national organizations are involved in protesting both the mine in the North Cascades and the mine in the White Clouds. And in both cases, you have national publications pitching this story and explaining and really being on the side of the conservationists in both cases. An important article appeared in Life magazine for the White Clouds campaign, and Harper's and the Atlantic published articles against the mine on Miner's Ridge. It becomes more connected in Idaho to gubernatorial politics. It becomes one of the really central pieces of the campaign in 1970 when Cecil Andrus beats Don Samuelson to be governor. Andrus always said that he was the first governor in the West elected on the conservation platform. The Miner's Ridge campaign did not have quite that close a connection with local politics.
So what about the conversation regarding Indigenous lands? And what I mean by that is, you know, we know that the land that we recreate on, I mean, that's potentially mined, even land that we live on. I mean, you could argue that all of it was stolen from Indigenous people. So are Indigenous groups becoming more a part of the conversation when we talk about this? Because I over the years, I mean, Native American tribes, they do come out, and they especially like with the White Clouds, they've come out and talked about the land and they want a voice. They haven't always been allowed to have a voice. Is that changing? Are we seeing these groups being a part of the conversation?
Well, I think absolutely we are. And just for instance, there's a proposal right now circulating to reopen an open pit gold mine in Idaho. Mm-hmm. An article that I saw just last week about this, the prominent group that is opposing this as the Nez Perce tribe. But I would also point out that Native groups have been involved for a long time. I've done research on how Idahoans looked at the Wilderness Act before it was passed, and representatives from the Nez Perce tribe spoke in favor of the Wilderness Act as far back as 1961 at public hearings held. And so to suggest that they haven't been involved is not quite right, but
right.
I think it is true that Native groups are more involved in these issues. And as you point out, these are Indigenous lands, and all of them are Indigenous lands. And so it's certainly proper and right for Native groups to be part of this conversation, perhaps even driving this conversation.
So before I let you go, what do you think the conservations today can learn about resisting successfully?
What a good question. One of the lessons, I suppose, is just persistence. The groups that, like we talked about just a few minutes ago, the groups that got involved in 1966 and 67 had no idea how it was going to end. And so just persisting and going in day after day and month after month is one thing. I think another is to be creative. And I think we saw some creative activities in the campaign that I just wrote about. And people sometimes did it in a coordinated fashion, and sometimes they think they just thought it up on their own. And all of these people were in conversation with each other. And so I think building allies is important in making, increasing your odds at success. So I think that that would be an important thing as well. But relentless pressure is a really important thing that right. the conservationists exercised in the late 60s on the case of Miner's Ridge. And I think most of the places where they end up being successful, it is that relentless pressure.
Thank you so much for taking some time out today to talk with us about this. I appreciate it.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Well, we've been talking with University of Idaho professor Adam Sowers about his new book about saving a Washington state wilderness from a mine. Up next, Osher Institute classes go online. I'm Gemma Gaudette. More Idaho Matters right after this.